and just said, listen, I want to book a stand for Gymshark and we'll be here next year. At that next year, we brought the YouTubers over and the brand just completely blew up. To put things into perspective, before that event, Gymshark was selling £250, £350 a day in revenue in clothing. The first half an hour after the event, when we turned the website on, we sold £30,000 worth of product in 30 minutes.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Talent Takes Practice, a podcast looking at what it takes to make it to the top of your chosen field and how we can use this experience to help young people maximize their talents, whatever those talents may be. Now, this is an exciting day today. We've had some brilliant sports people, sports coaches, but today, somebody who has had enormous, almost unprecedented success in business. Ben Francis set up a company called Gymshark in 2012 from his parents' garage selling fitness supplements. A year later, they branched out designing and selling fitness apparel. Fast forward to 2020, and Gymshark, recently valued in excess of £1 billion, sells products in 131 different nations. And here's perhaps the most amazing thing of all. Ben is 28 years of age. He was just 19 when he started his company. Now, Roberto, I know you're a big gym goer. You're flexing the muscles as I look at you right now on Zoom. What do you make of this guy? I mean, we've been reading about it. In fact, it was you, I think, who suggested that we should get Ben onto the podcast.
Well, first and foremost, Matthew, it must be nice for Ben to be a pound behind you in the financial stakes, which is quite impressive, really.
And at least a million behind you, mate. You're raking it in.
But yeah, you know, for me, this is more of a business-minded podcast to see how somebody who might have wanted to be a sports person, I don't know Ben's history, but for him to achieve what he's achieved with his business mind is quite remarkable. A billionaire by the age of 28, you know, starting in his family's garage, desire, application. He's probably had knockbacks as well, competing against huge brands. You know, in the gym I go to, Matthew, you know, everybody now is walking around in Gymshark. So it's quite an incredible story. It just goes to show, if you've had disappointments, what can be achieved.
I agree with all that, Rob. And you know, the funny thing is this thing, initiative. You know what I mean? You're at school and you have a teacher telling you what you have to do. With a business, you've actually got to say, right, I'm going to start the business. I'm going to start sourcing clothing, textiles. I have to get a marketing channel together. I have to start hiring people. You know, having that at the age of 19 is pretty extraordinary. I mean, in football, I'd be interested to hear what it was like for you in football. Was it something that was directed for you? You know, you had coaches telling you what you needed to do. Or did you have to use your own initiative to decide, what club am I going to play for? Which coach am I going to reach out to? Who do I want to mentor me? And at Macclesfield, I've noticed a few times now, Rob, like you've reached out to Brendan Rodgers. How can I get help from him? How's the balance in sport, would you say?
Well, I don't think you have much choice as a youngster in football. You have, you know, you would be seen by a scout, then you would go to a football club, and then it's about your application, your pathway, and your own individual desire, I suppose, and a little bit of luck, you know, but you generate and create that own luck yourself. In terms of my role at Macclesfield, I'm trying to get experts around me who might be business-minded, who might know the club better than me, who might know the commercial deals better than me. You know, my expertise is in football. Some people might disagree. But, you know, if you can create a team around you who are experts in their individual thing, and mine's football, and you can create a team, that's where I'm going to listen and learn. Because I'm still learning at 46 about football. I'm learning about now the business side, which, you know, for what Ben has achieved is quite remarkable. The biggest thing I want to know, I know he went to Aston University, is he an Aston Villa fan? That's the big thing I want to know.
That's a good question. By the way, Rob, we're living through pandemic, right, at the moment. It's been tough for a lot of people. I just ask you, how are you bearing up? Think back to when this virus, we started hearing about it in January and February this year. Then in March, there was a lockdown. We're moving through to the end of the year, second wave and all the rest of it. Have you coped okay, mate? Has your sort of spirit been this? Because on the podcast, you're always upbeat, mate. You're always positive. But deep in it, you're smiling now. But what's it been like for you during this? I'm interested because I've got to tell you, I've had a couple of wobbles during this period.
Right.
A couple of periods where, you know, I'm quite an optimistic, upbeat kind of a guy. But, you know, when I've not been able to see my family, my parents, I've actually found it quite tough. How's it been for you?
To be fair, Matthew, the lockdown period, I've grown closer to my two boys. My eldest son, you know, we turned our garage into a gym. I've been able to train with Charlie on a daily basis before he went back to Manchester United. And that's really made us closer. Freddie, my youngster, as you know, I'm a manager of his under-15 side, so I've been able to do one-on-one sessions with him in the garden, helping him on his technique. So for me, I've enjoyed being in that family environment a lot more, which for me is, I've really enjoyed it. And with Zoom with my mum, you know, my mum lives in Wrexham, and obviously we haven't seen my mother for a number of months, but with Zoom now, you can, you know, every day I'm FaceTiming her, I'm Zooming her. Technology, she's not the greatest at, but in a strange kind of way, I've grown closer. You know, I've got a 17-year-old boy who's just passed his test and he's driving everywhere. The worry has gone up tenfold. You know, every time he gets in his car, I'm a bag of nerves. But he's growing up, and I've seen from lockdown the way he's grown into a fine young man. You know, he's got his independence, and they've got to go sometimes. So it's, in one way, I've grown so close to the pair of them, but in another way, my eldest now has got his independence, and it's, I want him back here. Do you know what I mean? It's hard.
I know.
And I'm dreading both boys leaving home. Wow.
You know, it's funny, Rob. It's funny, mate, because Teddy and Evie, they're now 8 and 6. So we're doing this at 10 in the morning. Evie's had a sleepover at a friend's house because children are allowed to go into other households. And I've got to tell you, that feeling when she left, and I thought, is she going to come back? And then fast forward in 10 years to when she goes to university, I can see Ben has now joined us. Ben Francis is in the building. Ben, thank you so much for joining us today. You know what, Ben? We were thinking about doing this podcast, and we were thinking, who are the people, the most inspirational people we can get on? And nobody said you. No, they did. Robbie came straight in on WhatsApp, and he said, have you heard about this guy, Ben Francis? And I said, it's weird you say that. In the Times yesterday, this is a few weeks ago, there was a story about him. Now, Times readers, I write for the Times newspaper, they can be quite cynical. But when they read about your story and how you got to where you've got to, the amount of positive comments, the amount of admiration was incredible. So we thought we'd start with a slightly unusual way. If you were advising a young entrepreneur, somebody who wanted to start a business, you know, say you're in the dragon's den and you're the dragon, what would be the best bit of advice you could give?
Oh, wow. That's a big question to start with. To be honest, it's probably just that age-old thing of do what you love. So I just completely fell into Gymshark, right? And I wish I could say it was this, like, huge structured plan as to how we'd get to where we are today. But I literally fell into it. Like, I just fell in love with the gym at 16 years old. And I just wanted to be involved in the fitness industry in any way that I could. And by the way, the reason I fell in love with the gym, by the way, was literally because it's the first thing in my life, and I don't know how, if this might relate to football actually, is that whereas at school, I felt like I could try really hard and not get a hell of a lot out of it. Whereas with the gym, if I knew that if I turned up 5 days a week, then in a year's time, I would be better off in a year than I was when I started. And to me, that was really, really powerful. And I just fell in love with the gym. And I just wanted to be involved in any way possible. So yeah, my biggest piece of advice would be just do what you love.
As you can see, Ben, Matthew does not go to the gym.
That is so harsh. Yeah, I've got to tell you that we have a cut. So we live in a 3-story house, and in the basement there is a gym. And so Kathy, my wife, has a Peloton bike, right, a nice treadmill. She has freestanding weights, and she has a trainer called Alice, who on Zoom every morning she does an hour. She was excited, but Rob, you're a massive gym person.
Yeah, I am. Listen, I'm Ben's right. You know, when I was a footballer, Ben, I was 9.5 stone, and for me, I never really done the gym. It was my athleticism, my energy that got me around the park. But as soon as I retired, I needed that focus, that mental, you know, for my mind to have a routine every day. So I've got a few training partners. And for me, to actually put size on was, you know, I could see me improving. And I was always that guy in school, Ben, who was skinny. My nickname was Ribs. Yeah. I was scared to, you know, my mum would have to get, honestly, my mum would have to give me a note when we went swimming because I didn't want to show my body off because I was so skinny and I was, there was something in my mind, I can't go swimming because, you know, I look so thin. So for me, Ben, the gym, since I retired, has just been mentally so good.
It's funny you say that because I follow, I mean, I'm into my football and I've got a bone to pick with you as well because I am a Villa fan. And you broke my heart when I was a kid with the old Dion Dublin incident.
Oh, Ben!
The Dion Dublin incident.
Ben, I'm sorry, Ben, I'm sorry. But you could see in those games, Ben, how thin I was. The shirts were so big on me. And the thing is with Gymshark, Ben, you look at the clothing and it's everybody in... where I go to the gym is wearing Gymshark. It's tight. Ooh. But if I would ever put a tight top on when I was playing in the Premier League, I wouldn't have. I used to wear two pairs of trousers when I was a kid because my legs were that thin to go out, Ben, honestly, to make me look bigger. So now the gym, I love wearing the tight fitting gear now, which is Gymshark is just a remarkable product.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. It's been a crazy few years, honestly. It's been absolutely nuts. But yeah, it's funny that you say that because I follow Rio Ferdinand on Instagram as well. And I feel like he's living in the gym now. It's funny. I feel like a lot of footballers seem to be jumping on it post-career.
Yeah.
Do you know, maybe there is, you know, what you were saying there, Ben, about how you can track your progress. You know, each workout, there's a correlation between how much you put in and what you get out in terms of physical bulk, how you feel about yourself. I think that intimate relationship psychologically is quite an important thing. Mm-hmm. And also what Rob said about switching off, maybe particularly at a time of pandemic when there is anxiety, there is a bit of fear, understandable, mm-hmm. and then being able to switch off. There's a kind of, Robbie, is there a kind of escapism to going into the gym, you know, getting away from it all?
Yeah, it's my meditation. Like whether it's, I mean, during lockdown, I got into sort of running and doing something like other things. But yeah, for me, it's just an hour in the day where I'm just on my own in the craziness of life, particularly sort of running Gymshark every single day. Is just, there's so many different problems to solve. There's so many different places to be. So just to have that consistent hour every day where I can just switch off is so powerful.
Back with the next question shortly. But first, we're going to tell you about this.
We love to learn and learn with purpose. It's so empowering knowing we can do better, feel better, be better. So this year, we're continuing to learn with purpose using the Great Courses Plus.
You get unlimited streaming access to thousands of video courses on virtually anything that interests you. Learn how to master Tai Chi or public speaking. Take your oceanography knowledge to greater depths. Learn how to read body language. The Great Courses Plus has something for everyone, and it's all thoroughly vetted, fact-based information you can trust from some of the world's best professors and top experts in their fields all over the world.
What purpose waits for you? Sign up for The Great Courses Plus to find out. We have a special URL to use, thegreatcoursesplus.com/talent.
You'll get an entire month of unlimited access for free. Don't miss out on this, trust us. Again, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/talent.
So in school, Ben, did you want to be a sportsman at all? What was your favourite? I know you're a Villa fan. But did you want to be a footballer? Did you want to be a tennis player? Did you want to be a sports person? That dream when you were 6, 7, 8, I had posters in my bedroom of football. Did you want to be a sportsman?
Yes, I wanted to. My dream was to play for Villa.
Was it really?
My entire childhood was to play for Villa. My heroes growing up was Dion Dublin, Lee Hendry, all the, you know, and then as we got sort of later on, Martin Larsson, Olof Melberg, people like that were just heroes to me. So I guess by the time I got into the gym, 16 years old, I knew that I was never going to be a professional footballer. So I think that's when I started to explore different things that I wanted to do and fell in love with the gym.
Okay, so we've got to drill down into this, Rob. There are not many 16-year-old people who have the aspiration. I mean, you say you fell into it. Mm. Could you give us, you know, kind of a detailed chronology of where you were at 16, mm-hmm. where you grew up, you know, about your family background,
yep.
and how you ended up as somebody who was selling a stake in an incredibly successful business to private equity?
Right. So as a kid, growing up, I was heavily influenced by obviously my family, as everyone is, and sort of work experience, which I think you do at about 14 years old, I think it is. I did work experience with my granddad, and he ran a firm that lines furnaces with ceramic fibre and brick. So we would go around different areas of the Midlands and basically rock up in his van and we'd line the furnaces. And that taught me a lot of things, like, because he would tell me stories, right, about the risks that he took. And at 14 years old, to hear your granddad talking about how he remortgaged the house to ship a furnace off to Germany and didn't know if he would get the money and the risks that he took, I think at an early age, that, you know, allowed me to sort of think about the way, like, risk management and taking risk. And it actually made me really comfortable with taking financial risk, which I think has definitely helped Gymshark to today. After that, as I got to sort of 17, 18, I worked at Pizza Hut as a delivery driver. I went to school, obviously, and got into my A-levels. So my GCSEs, which is up to the age of 16, I wasn't particularly good. It was probably, you know, average. It was Ds, it was Cs, it wasn't great. And I think a lot of that was around the fact that it was quite test-based and I probably didn't apply myself in the way that I should. And I didn't actually get into sixth form, which is the 17, 18 sort of A-levels period. And my mum sort of grabbed me around the scruff of the neck and she was like, right, you're gonna work and you're gonna do really well. Because I know that if you apply yourself, you could be brilliant. And she sort of went to the school and she asked the school if they would let me in. Fortunately, they had one more space, so they let me stay into sixth form, which was brilliant for me. But on the premise that I did English literature, which I hated, but I was really good at it, business studies and IT. Now, IT was one of the important moments in my life because, like I said previously, it was very much examination based. And the first IT lesson we did, they sat an old Windows 95 computer in front of us. There's probably like 10, 15 people in the class. And they said, right, you've got 2 hours, get into this computer. And it was locked. And all of a sudden I was like, right, here we go. Now this is me. This is like a real application of skill. And I learned web development. I learned mobile development. I learned how to use all these different pieces of software. I taught myself video editing and all these things. And I was just fascinated with the practical application of skill. Now, during that period, I fell into the gym, and I think it was similar to Rob's story, is I was always the skinny kid at school. I wasn't particularly comfortable in my own skin, and I wanted to sort of build up a bit of muscle. So went to my local gym, and like I said, I just fell in love with it. In terms of the Gymshark story, there's so many stars that had to align. And I think one of those stars, by the way, is the fact that 20 minutes away from where I grew up at the Birmingham NEC, they did, like, I think the best fitness event in Europe every single year, an event called Body Power. And for me and my mates, that was like a pilgrimage. That was like the place that we went to because all of our heroes would go there at like 17, 18, 19. And that event was the thing that inspired me just to be involved in fitness. At that point, because of my practical skills I'd learned in IT, I just made websites, I made iPhone apps. So prior to starting Gymshark, I made 4 iPhone apps. I think 2 of them made them into the charts. And then,
Go on, what did the apps do, the two that made it into the charts?
So one was like a fitness guide, basically. Super, super basic. So one was basically how to burn fat and one was basically workouts. And you had a calendar, you could populate your calendar on your phone with workouts and stuff. And they were super basic, but they did well because at the time, no one was really doing apps, to be honest. Just made the Gymshark website because I wanted to be involved in fitness. And I didn't add clothes onto the website because that just wasn't the ambition. It was just an involvement in the industry that I loved. And because I didn't have the money to put anything else on the website. In fact, I'll tell you what. Locally, so there's a place called Longbridge, which is not far from where I grew up, and there's a company called USN, which were based there. And one of my mates actually worked there, and I went to him when I was starting the Gymshark website, and I said, listen, can I just buy some supplements to put on the website? And the minimum order was £8,000. Now, at 18, 19 years old, the likelihood of me getting my hands on £8,000 was just impossible. That was like more money than I'd ever seen in my life. So at that point, I thought, right, how am I going to do this? So I loaded the website up with every supplement you can possibly imagine and drop shipped supplements from the website. And it was only making like £1-2 profit an order. But I'd had a website that could transact and I'll never forget.
Sorry, Ben, just slow down. You've got the website. You didn't have 8,000 for a bulk order.
Yeah.
Just explain what you did instead.
So I did something called drop shipping. So what you can do is load the website up with images of products. someone goes on the website and orders a product and you ship it for someone else, and the difference between the cost that you ship it for and what you charge is obviously a small margin. So what the website would do would ship other people's product, and people, it would look on the surface as though it was Gymshark. And that was the first way that I worked out how to sell product without having to own it, because I couldn't afford to own the product.
Wow.
Got it. Wow. By the way, look, obviously there's some part of the journey still
fast
to go.
Fast, unbelievable.
I just hope that, it's brilliant. Wow. So there's so many different bits to unravel here, but one of them, I hope there are head teachers and teachers listening to this, because this educational paradigm of giving kids exams where they answer closed questions, what about the practical skills that Ben is talking about? All these young people who want to go out and actually do, to experiment, to try new things, to develop their practical skills. There isn't enough of that in education. So I'm really glad, Ben, that that was something that you felt was a seminal, pivotal moment for you. But then you've got this risk-taking that you mentioned. You learned this from your grandfather, who invested, I think, a certain amount of money to get what he needed. But you also took risks on building apps. You didn't know whether there'd be a gap in the market. You had to take a risk on investing your time in order to create an app. So you're now thinking creatively about how to look for those things. That to me is fascinating, because even if Gymshark hadn't worked, you'd have been looking for other opportunities to do things. In other words, risk-taking, it's not a one-off. It's a state of mind, isn't it?
Yeah, and so Gymshark, for perspective, was the seventh website that I'd made. So I feel like a lot of people look at Gymshark and go, oh, wow, that was brilliant. But it was, for lack of a better term, you know, throwing shit at the wall and some of it will stick. And Gymshark at the time was the one that did stick. So you're right, it wasn't just the only one that I tried and then it succeeded.
And by the way, Ben, that's true of almost all great entrepreneurs. You look at Henry Ford, his first company went bankrupt. It wasn't a success, but he took deep lessons about cost, about production efficiency. He took that into the Ford Motor Company that changed the world. James Dyson, Richard Branson. You know, most of these people are prepared to give it a go. They mess up. They sometimes fail. Sometimes apps don't work, but they have the resilience to keep going, to keep seeking out those opportunities. Do you think, Ben, there's anything in Rob? Sorry, you come in here, mate. But this is genuinely interesting. You know, what do you think it is in you that gave you that temperament? You know, you've mentioned your grandfather. What about your parents? What about your social life? What was going on, do you think, that incubated that attitude?
Yeah. So in the early days, I had a brilliant upbringing, Like we weren't massively wealthy by any stretch of the imagination, but. So I'll give you an example is when I decided to leave university, like I'd worked so hard to get into university. Like I said, GCSEs weren't great. I did my A-levels and I got into Aston, which again was like a dream come true. And I called my mum and dad and said, listen, I'm dropping out. It was after the first year, so the start of the second year. And the only thing they said to me, they were like, are you sure this is what you want to do? Are you sure that you think this is right? They didn't want me to leave university, but the second I made the decision to leave university, they fully and wholeheartedly backed that decision. And I think that really helps as well.
You know, Ben, going back to you were 16 and you said, you know, you were the skinny kid. And when I started the gym, there was a bit of nervousness because in the gym, everybody's fit, they had muscles. And when I started and I was so skinny, I thought, wow, I thought everybody was looking at me thinking, why is he doing weights? You know, I started on fives or tens. And you're thinking, wow, am I ever going to get muscles? And you must have been in that position walking into the gym for the first time, the skinny kid, thinking, look at all these like massive muscles on everybody, and thinking, am I ever going to get like that? So that's hard, isn't it? That's hard, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's one of the feelings I had going into the gym that eventually sparked the Gymshark community that we built today. Because you're right, it's this weird experience where everyone's thinking about themselves in the gym. Am I doing this shoulder press right? Am I doing this bicep curl right? Why am I too skinny? Why am I too whatever? But in reality, no one else is looking at you. Everyone's just thinking about themselves. So there's this weird experience where everyone's there to develop and improve themselves, but they're all worried about themselves and thinking everyone else is judging them. So that's why I think in fitness, which more often than not is quite a solitary pursuit, it's quite interesting and powerful to have a community that backs you and allows you to learn things.
Can I just pick up the story? Thank you, Ben. Just pick up the story where we were at. So forgive me if I've misunderstood, but at the beginning, you're effectively connecting buyers and sellers on a small margin with a reasonably efficient automated platform.
Yeah.
But now, again, I'm not a gym person, so I don't know. But you make your money from selling clothing.
Yeah.
Exactly. How did you go from effectively selling supplements or being a broker for these exchanges to now being the dominant clothing brand in gym?
So we went to the event, Body Power, which I mentioned to you. And as we were walking around, everyone's wearing these sort of big stringer vests. And we were as kids, we were inspired by two very sort of different things, right? Lifters in California, Ronnie Coleman, Arnold Schwarzenegger, the big guys that were wearing product and clothes that we just couldn't wear because we just weren't big enough. And then on the other end of the spectrum, like I'm sure all kids of my age at the time, Topman 2 for £10 t-shirts, skinny jeans and all that sort of stuff. So we weirdly morphed Californian bodybuilding with European more fitted and like physique accentuating style and basically built the clothes that we wanted to wear. And again, it wasn't a case of, oh, there's an opportunity in clothing, because to be honest, I didn't think there was. Like anyone that's looking at the fitness or sportswear market will probably think that, you know, there isn't an opportunity because there's so many big players there. So we just essentially bought a screen printer and a sewing machine and made the clothes that we wanted to wear to the gym ourselves.
Sorry, just say that again. You did what? Yeah.
So again, that was another thing. So a screen printer is essentially the way that you print logos onto things, and a sewing machine is obviously a sewing machine. Saved up, I think it was about £1,200 through working at Pizza Hut and doing the Gymshark website, and spent all that on those two things so that we could hand make product. So at the start, we were making the clothes that we wanted to wear to the gym because no one else was making it, because the American brands such as Nike and Under Armour were quite baggy and it just wasn't speaking to us. And there wasn't too much going on here in the UK and Europe. So we just made the clothes that we wanted to wear to the gym that would accentuate our physiques, young lifters at the time. And then started putting it on the website. We, it just started to sell, I guess, particularly after we'd sent it out to a lot of social media stars.
It's quite incredible to think, Ben, what you've achieved. You know, all the IT stuff, you know, the screen printing. Matthew can't even turn his own computer on. His wife had to do it for him in the mornings. And he writes for the Times. Quite pathetic, Matthew. As an inspirational man.
That's a valid criticism. And I've got to sort that IT lack of knowledge out. But on the actual making of the code, who did it? Did you do it? Did you ask somebody to come in and do operate the sewing machine?
No, so screen printer was taught by a lad that lived local to us, and he came and taught me how to do it. And then the sewing was I was taught by my nan and my mum. So my nan would make curtains, and my mum knew how to use a sewing machine, so she taught me how to do it, essentially. So my average day would look like Aston University up until 3 or 4 p.m. My Pizza Hut shift would usually run about 5 p.m. to 10 p.m., usually half 10 by the time you've cleaned up. And then Gymshark would be sort of my evenings and weekends thing, essentially.
Wow.
And and just to round the story off, am I right in thinking that in order to make an apparel brand, a clothing brand, really work, it's partly to do with how it looks, how it feels, but you also need an image. You need to create an image. I mean, obviously your founding story is an incredibly powerful one, the way that you actually built this brand. But how did you think about the marketing? How did you manage to get that brand idea into the minds of your potential consumers? You know, what was the vision behind building it as a retail brand?
So, like I said, in terms of making the product, we made the product that we wanted to wear. And the way that we marketed it, or the way that we interacted with people, is the way that we wanted other companies to interact with us. So as a kid growing up, didn't really watch TV other than football. It was all, everything was on YouTube. So our heroes were the lifters that we learned everything from on YouTube. And there was a guy called Lex up in Manchester. There was a bunch of people over in California and a guy in Germany. So we just sent our product that we loved out to them, not for them to wear or market, but it was, we love this product. We think it's great. What do you think? And by the way, if you like it, it would be great for us because they are our heroes. These guys started wearing the product in their YouTube videos. And, you know, it just built up this furore because it was a product that no one else was making. Fast forward a year, we went back to that Body Power Expo, and walking around, I just had this sort of innate feeling that we had to be there. So went straight up to the stand where you book the show. And I just said, listen, I want to book a stand for Gymshark and we'll be here next year. At that next year, we brought the YouTubers over and the brand just completely blew up. And I think at this event, we'd inadvertently made a lot of the marketing sort of mix that a lot of people see today in terms of a small offline presence, online purchasing, product that's, you know, only semi-available because it's low in stock, which wasn't on purpose, by the way. And also working with influencers and social media stars, because we brought the stars to the show. Because we weren't at home making the product, we had to turn everything out of stock on the website. The show went crazy and completely sold out. And then after the show, on the evenings, we would just chat to everyone else that was at the event and say, hey guys, do you want to head down to Ironworks and get a lift in? And we inadvertently started to create this social media community, because then all these people would chat to us on Facebook afterwards. And yeah, I mean, we created that marketing mix inadvertently there. And to put things into perspective, before that event, Gymshark was selling £250-£350 a day in revenue in clothing. The first half an hour after the event, when we turned the website on, we sold £30,000 worth of product in 30 minutes. Wow. And then it was from there that it's been like a blink of an eye that the last 7 years of my life have just flown by, essentially.
Why Gymshark? Why the name Gymshark?
See, I wish I could come up with some elaborate story about me swimming off the coast of wherever. But because, like I said, because it was such an arbitrary decision, it was the seventh website that I'd made. It was just a cool, short domain name that looked quite cool on the GoDaddy website, and it cost about £3. So I literally saw an American football mascot, and it was like a big cat, and it was quite a muscular-looking thing because it was for American football. And I just thought, well, that would be cool if it was a shark. So just bought the Gymshark domain because, like I said, I didn't know it was going to be anything huge.
Wow.
Rob, I'm interested in your perspective on this because you're a footballer. You've now been very entrepreneurial in how you've transitioned out of football, you know, on radio, on television. You present your own TV program. You've now gone into coaching youth football, Macclesfield, director of football. You know, how have you navigated? Can you see parallels between Ben's willingness to take decisions and take risks? I know on a slightly different scale and in a different context, but I've got to say, right, I don't embarrass you here. I think you're very entrepreneurial. You know, after we did that first pod with Fred, the pilot in Manchester, you were on the phone. You know, what could we do differently and better? You created the WhatsApp group so we could start sharing ideas about how we could get our pod to be better. I think you use your initiative a lot.
I do, but, and please come in if I'm wrong, that as a footballer, you get paid to play football and you get paid very well. Whereas Ben, going back to his granddad, taking massive risks, financial risks of, you know, Ben wasn't getting paid to make the stuff, was he, or to get the supplements. So he was putting his own money out, whereas a footballer, I would be getting paid because of my hard work and my effort. I was getting rewarded for my product on the football pitch, whereas Ben has had to do it all himself. You understand what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree there is. I mean, on that point, actually, Ben, you're doing this stuff. You know, you're trying to scale this business. What was the scariest moment for you? Was the scary moment when you walk into that expo equivalent and you're thinking, is anyone going to be interested? Or was it more scary when you sold £30,000 worth of stock in the half an hour after the show and you're thinking, what have I got on my hands here?
So I would say probably the scariest thing, but one of the most powerful things and the things that I love the most about the job now would be the initial responsibility. So in terms of, I guess, Rob growing up and as a footballer, the difference between what you did and what I did is yes, you got paid for it, but you're in the spotlight. Do you know what I mean? You're in constant competition. I had the luxury of being able to focus on my craft in utter, like without the spotlight, with no one looking at what we're doing, which means we could fail endlessly and there would be no comeback on us. Whereas I'm sure even from the age of 18, 19, 20, you make one mistake and there's going to be 100 people that will be onto you for it. We never had that.
Yeah, great point.
So, it's a great point.
So I think that was powerful. And then the thing that I guess would be scary, because again, I didn't find financial risk particularly scary. And there's been three or four times where before the age of 22, I'd risked every penny I had on Gymshark being successful. And I didn't ever find that scary. But the thing that I did find scary was the responsibility of bringing on staff members at a young age was tough, because especially when, you know, you can get into this mindset of thinking if this doesn't happen, then it's going to negatively affect people's lives. And the initial responsibility of that was tough. But probably the single most scary thing was not only hiring staff members, but giving them the responsibilities that I once held. So I think a lot of people call it letting go. There were certain areas of the business which I was outwardly terrible at, but really, really enjoyed. And I'll never forget, we brought in a great ops guy. I'm terrible with ops and I'm okay with tech. And I built basically a back-end system that would connect the Gymshark website to the Royal Mail system, okay? So when Gymshark gets orders, we would print off Royal Mail labels and Royal Mail would come up and pick up the orders. This guy came in on his first day. He looked at this thing that I'd made that I was so proud of. And he was like, this is terrible. This has to go. It's on the verge of breaking. And that completely and utterly broke my heart. Like, honestly, I was sat there in the room just like heartbroken at the fact this thing that I worked so hard on was being told it was, he was telling everyone that it was terrible. And that it, what's even worse is that he was right. It was terrible. So I found it scary, not only having the responsibility of having a team, but also letting go and allowing them to fail and run the business.
That's incredibly interesting because I don't know if you know, Ben, I have a consultancy that advises business on
culture. It's not about you, Matthew, this podcast.
Rob's not about you, Matthew. But you know Soho House.
Yeah, great brand.
So this is a brilliant brand, a founder-led business. You know, Nick Jones is still in there every day. He's still as motivated as he was in the day that he started the company off. So I went and spoke to his senior leadership team about 3 weeks ago at the Ned Hotel. And in the book, so this would have been before some of the social restrictions came in. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting, Ben, that when you have a founder mm-hmm. driving a company, it's very difficult for the people to tell that founder where they think he or she is going wrong. Because mm-hmm. this is the person who is, you know, the brand. This is a person who has decisions over pay and promotions. How difficult was it for you to create an environment where people would say, Ben, we think you're getting it wrong? Because you need to hear that sometimes. Because even if the yeah. founder is a great visionary, they don't know everything. You know, you didn't know as much as you needed to know about ops and logistics. Yeah. You know, how do you create, I mean, I'm interested in this from a business perspective, but how do you create that culture of openness and what you might call constructive dissent?
Yeah, so I think, like I said, it all comes back to the core. So in the initial days, I think I surrounded myself with brilliant, brilliant people, the vast majority of which are still with us today. And I think the other thing as well, the thing that I found powerful is me showing vulnerability. So me almost having a chip at myself and going, I'm not very good at this, because then I think it opens up the door for other people to do the same. Going back to bringing other people on board, about 5 years ago, I stepped down as chief exec and brought in a better chief exec than I was. So again, I think if you constantly reinforce it, not through telling, but through actions, there's a saying that I absolutely love, and it's not what you preach, but it's what you tolerate. And I think that's so important, because you can tell people all day, I can go, oh, you know, guys, you know, if I'm wrong, tell me. But if they tell me I'm wrong and then I, you know, shout them down or ignore it, then it's completely irrelevant. So right. I think it's all about, again, what you're actually doing.
Yeah, quite right. And by the way, you say you brought in the chief executive. So what happened to your role at the point that you have somebody effectively running your business? Did you still own the equity at that point?
Yeah. So there was nothing, I guess, in terms of shareholding, but it was all about the day-to-day. So basically, Gymshark started to grow rapidly, right? And it was about... It was about a year before we were sort of awarded as the UK's fastest growing business. So I saw this happening. I saw this growth coming, because you normally see it a year or two before. And I knew that where it was going was to a stage which I essentially wouldn't have been able to manage. And I've seen other businesses act in a more lifestyle business way. And by the way, I'm not saying that this is right or wrong, but some people love having a business, particularly entrepreneurs, that they can touch everything. They know everything that's moving and everything that's going on. Now, I met a couple of guys, a guy called Paul and a guy called Steve, who's now chief exec and chairman. And they sat down and they literally said, do you want to be the biggest brand in like the Birmingham area? Or do you want to, which you could do and you can touch everything, that's fine and that's great and you can live a great life. Or are we going to try and make this into one of the biggest brands in the world? And obviously I said, I want to make this into one of the biggest brands in the world. What that then triggered is the fact that I need to focus on what I'm good at and bring in people that would be better at me than the things that I'm not good at. Now, that's when Steve came in, and Steve focused on all the back end of the business, the finance, the ops, the logistics, and I focused purely on marketing, brand and product. And that was very, very freeing for me, because I could almost have my cake and eat it at this point, because the business benefited from the fact that I was focusing on my strengths. Steve would fix all the weaknesses and build a brilliant structure and culture in the business. But I could dip into the things that I wasn't very good at and give them a go and fail, knowing I had the safety blanket of Steve being there as an expert to tidy up any mistakes that I did make, which not only allowed the business to grow rapidly, but it allowed me to develop myself at a rate that would have been impossible otherwise.
We're back with the next question shortly, but first we want to tell you about this.
Investing is one of the best ways to grow wealth over the long term. However, high commissions and clunky products from traditional stockbrokers can sometimes make it complicated for people to start investing. Meanwhile, trillion-dollar companies get built, but very few people benefit from that wealth creation.
The intuitive design makes investing simple for any experience level. Beginners and experts alike, you can start investing from just £2.
They are all about long-term investing with a transparent pricing model and no hidden fees or inflated spreads. When you invest, your capital is at risk. The value of investments can go up as well as down, and you may receive back less than your original investment. Go to freetrade.io/talent, and if you register and fund your account, you'll get a randomly allocated free share worth between £3 and £200, such as Greg's, Rightmove, or Apple.
For more information, visit freetrade.io.
It's fascinating, Matthew. At the start of the pod, you said about the director of football at Macclesfield, and I've listened to Jurgen Klopp say about he gets specialists in, like he had the throwing guy, didn't he, the coach?
Right.
He's got specialists in every area, and he designates. And I think what Ben is saying there, the most successful people realise they have to designate to experts in their field, which is quite fascinating. Mm. It's fascinating.
And by the way, it's difficult to do, because we want to have control, don't we? To relinquish control over something that you care deeply about, that's a difficult ask. And I think that is one of the weaknesses, particularly when a business is scaling fast. And yours was scaling at an incredible rate of knots. By the way, one thing that does interest me, and I think, Rob, it'd be interesting to hear your view on this, the parallel. You know, one thing about young footballers, as they get better, as they become more successful, as they start making more money, they can find it challenging from a perspective of their personal life. You know, how am I going to handle all of this money? Now I'm a bit of a celebrity. They want us to be seen in the glitzy nightclubs and the VIP areas. The footballers who are successful know how to manage their own lives. You know, they get hit on by women who might not have their best interests at heart, trying to sell a story. You know, Rob, you can see what I'm talking about here. I'm guessing for you, Ben, now you're a famous, renowned, celebrated young British icon. You're getting to that stage. How have you handled the personal dimension of all this? In other words, do you have a girlfriend? I mean, there's going to be girls listening in here. They're going to be like, how can we get his email address?
Yeah, I've got an absolutely amazing girlfriend. She's called Robin. She's absolutely brilliant, and she like gives me so much stability in my life. And again, that was advice that I was given from an early age from Steve. Was you need to have a sort of a structured and robust personal life, because everything else doesn't matter after that. And I've had that advice from so many successful people ever since. Just the importance of having a stable personal life to allow yourself to succeed professionally.
I totally agree with that from a footballer's perspective. You know, my wife been with each other 23 years. She's the rock of our family. You know, without her, I couldn't achieve what I achieved. So we're a partnership. Amazing, amazing. So Ben is spot on. That stability. Matthew, your wife as well, Cathy.
Rob, sorry. I know, that's a really good, sincere point. But Ben, I've got to ask you a question. Do you know what Rob gave to Sarah for her first birthday present when they first got together?
Oh, God. What was it? Not a blue shirt.
No, Ben, worse. So Ben, basically what it
honestly,
was
I, let me the first tell time Ben. He told me this
so
oh,
Ben
man,
so basically
is...
when I'm at my wife Ben my wife a lot of the time my girlfriend in Chester, I phoned her for 6 months. She gave me a number and she wasn't having any of it. So I was at Crewe and I got released from Crewe. I would run out of contract, so I was in between clubs. I didn't know if I was going to continue to be a footballer. I didn't know what was going to happen. So I was 19 and I had a chance to go to Malmo in Sweden. So I thought, right, I've got to try and get it nailed down here. I knew I was going to marry this woman. So it was Crystal Palace, Leicester or Malmo. So I thought I'll go with the Malmo one first, because I'm going to go to Sweden. I might not see you again. You know, make your mind up. Anyway, so what I did, Ben, I cut a piece of my hair off. And I put it in a locket and on a chain, and I give it to her. I said, listen, I might be going to Malmo just in case we don't see each other again. This is for me. She opened it.
Fucking hell.
Piece of my hair. Ben,
she what was,
Dion, Ben, now you know why Dion Dublin headbutted me.
Yeah. I was going to say, she didn't ask for a restraining order. Did someone send me your hair?
Ben, 23 years later, Ben, we're still together. Oh, two wonderful kids.
Yeah. One of the absolute classics of all time. Oh, mate.
So going back to that, Ben, Matthew mentioned about how your life has changed. And, you know, Mm-hmm. Obviously, you wanted to be a footballer, and you're probably seeing all your heroes driving nice cars, living in, you know, beautiful houses, wearing nice clothes. Has your life changed in any way where you could now have these things?
Yeah, I mean, money gives you choice. But yeah. I saw, again, that's all. It doesn't bring anything else other than choice. It just means you can drive a slightly nicer car or live in a slightly larger house, but it makes no difference other than that, I find. I mean, again, I've had lots of advice on that in terms of if you're part crazy and you're given a lot of money, then you'll be full crazy pretty darn quick. And I think just things like that have really helped me. I've had brilliant advice throughout my childhood and throughout my sort of late teens and early 20s, which has really helped me. But yeah, obviously life has changed for me. But ultimately, my focus always has been and always will be making this into the best community and brand in the world. And I spend, you know, I feel like I've got the best job in the world. So I'm very fortunate to be doing what I do.
Can I ask you whether or not the fact that, I mean, I'm guessing I will, you know, I kind of can anticipate how you might answer this, but has the fact that you've now made millions of pounds blunted your ambition? Robbie, you sometimes see this in football, right? When young players start getting the big paychecks, they stop putting in the hard yards on the training pitch. Have you found any of that? Any time you've woken up and said, well, I've made these millions, why do I need to go into work? I'm just going to chill out today.
Yeah, and being completely candid and transparent, that was a genuine concern. I thought to myself, is this going to happen to me? Because again, being a big football fan, yeah, I've heard all those sorts of things being said. But I'm really happy to say that my ambition and hunger is more than it's ever been. Like since, you know, doing well for myself, it feels like I just want it more and more and more. And it's like that snowball's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And yeah, I mean, I'm just loving my job more and more. I guess the only negative right now, which is one of the things that I have loved about my job in the last few years, is I've been able to travel the world. Like there's been years when I was doing like 50 flights a year across, you know, Australia, the Americas, Asia, Europe, everything, being able to meet so many cool people. And that's probably the only thing at the moment that I'm really missing. But yeah, my hunger and desire is more than it's ever been.
Yeah, fantastic to hear, Rob. Looking back on your football career, are there players that you think could have been world-class players,
yeah,
Premier League players?
Yeah, lots,
who just didn't make that?
Lots. And listen, they were far better players than me. But I think in all successful people, there's a hunger, there's a desire. You have to choose the right pathway. For me, I have to work harder than everybody else in what I've done as a footballer, because we talked about my physical attributes in the media, because I never won. I never played the Champions League, and I never played in a major tournament. So for me, every single day, I have to be prepared better than my opponent, by the pundit I'm working with, by, you know, even at now director of Macclesfield, I'll have to do all the due diligence on the team we're playing. So I've got my research and my focus has to be better than the person I'm up against, and that's always been my motto.
Ben, let me ask you, with all of our podcasts, we always ask three set piece questions.
Oh God.
So can I kick off with the first one?
Yeah.
What was we kind of got a sense of this already, but you might take it in your own way. What was the weakest part of your skill set and the one that you had to work the hardest to improve on?
People management, hands down. People management, because no.
I'm
no...
surprised at that. Are you surprised at that, Rob?
You seem so intelligent, so confident.
You do. Yeah. So, yeah. My skill set, my strength, particularly growing up, was all around creativity, like very slightly sort of autistic, so obsessive over certain things. Like I said, same clothes every day, same breakfast, same lunch, same tea, gym. Like, I'm so consistent with that. And I was very. As I think maybe footballers and entrepreneurs are, I was quite hot-headed at times. So this is interesting, actually, because I've found, and again, I think this is similar to football. I think there's consistencies here. My role in the business has vastly changed with each sort of period of growth. So when the business first started, it was very much build this business and grow it, almost grab it by the scruff of the neck and grow it by any means necessary. Now, as the business developed and we started to build a team of individuals, you can't do that because you alienate people. And I think I went through a period of definitely alienating people because designs would come through that didn't fit my vision. And rather than being constructive and proactive with my feedback, I was probably a bit too, you know, too aggressive or direct with the feedback. And that just didn't work. So I've really had to develop that and work on it and work on my people management skills and the way I communicate, public speaking, presenting, all those sorts of things. None of that comes naturally to me. I'm much more introverted and creative and just go off and make my own thing. So I've had to really sort of work hard on that over the last few years.
It's interesting. So interesting. I had the same problem when it came to public speaking and being able to give presentations or broadcast. I said to Rob, first couple of radio interviews I did, as I was a table tennis player in my background, and I'd very occasionally get invited to do interviews. I actually would have a drink. I'd take a can of beer in my sports bag because I was just very nervous. You know, I wouldn't be able to marshal my thoughts. My mouth would dry up. So I joined a club called Toastmasters. Which is like this global network of communities where people go and you get a chance to give a speech, and you have a really supportive group with you, and they give a speech and you get feedback. And I went there for 5 years to develop my social confidence. How did you sort of build your ability to do that?
Well, let me quickly say, you're a brilliant public speaker. Like the way that you hold the room, the way that you move across the stage, you hardly ever use the word you pause at the perfect moment. The way that you hold the audience is utterly brilliant. So
Thanks, Ben. You're talking about me now, Ben. I'm back. Oh, thanks, Ben. That's really nice of you, Ben.
I love that, Rob. Brilliant. Have you been to some of the of my events, or you've seen them on YouTube?
I've watched I've watched some of your talks on YouTube, and I watch Robbie whenever he's on the telly.
Oh, that's really kind. That's really kind. Thank you. Thank you very much,
Ben. Matthew's book. I don't know if you've read it. You'll be in the majority if you haven't. Black Box Thinking or Bounce, the 10,000 Hours one. Have you read that one?
No, not that one, no.
You should read it, Matthew, shouldn't you? It's fascinating, honestly.
But almost, Ben, in a funny kind of a way, listening to Ben, he would have been a perfect case study for Black Box Thinking. You know, in a funny kind of a way, for Rebel Ideas, which is about how when you bring diverse perspectives together, a leader who can listen to them, you get the best decisions overall. But you're a kind of living, breathing testament. Ben, can I just say, Rob, sorry, that's really kind of you to say that. I massively appreciate that feedback, Ben. Even though Rob was gutted. His face when you were saying that is like, oh, no, this is the one. Let me just quickly ask a second set-piece question. What is the one thing you have no talent in at all but wish you had?
Oh, wow. It's completely separate to the business. I wish I could play a musical instrument, which I just can't. That's probably one of the things that I wish I could do.
Yeah. Love it. Yeah, I kind of feel that way too. It's like that film, Groundhog Day, where Bill Murray, I don't know if you've seen that, Rob or Ben, this guy, Bill Murray, he's a weather presenter. Mm. He's a very cynical, jaundiced guy, but he lives the same day over and over and over again. And he decides to learn to play the piano. Mm. And he goes through it, and then at the end he plays this wonderful piece, and Andy McDowell, who's playing the romantic opposite number, falls in love with him. It's an amazing scene.
But just before your next question,
yeah, go on.
Ben, we haven't got long left, but you know that feeling when it was listed as a $1 billion business and you sold some equity in it, I believe. What was that feeling like the night before when you're thinking, oh, wow, what have I achieved? What was that feeling like? It's like for me, when I was going to sign for, when I was at Crewe, Ben, I was on £200 a week. And then when I was signing for Leicester, I was on £4,000 a week. And the night before, it was like, oh, wow, I can't believe it. I can help my mum. I can help my dad. I can help my brother. This kid from Wrexham on 250 quid a week to then thinking, oh, I'm going to be on £4,000 a week. It was £3,000 a week basic, and then it was £100,000 sign on fee. So it was £5,000 a week. And it was like, wow. The night before, there was butterflies. Is this really happening to me? I know I've worked hard. I know I've chosen the right pathways, but I can help so many people in my family. And I was so nervous, Ben. What was it like for you when it was going to, the night before?
Well, we'd been working on it for the best part of a year. And like there was so much like that you have to do that. I mean, I haven't even spoken about it, to be honest. There is so much that you have to do that builds up. And I can't even explain it. There's so many things that go through your head. There's proud of where we've come from. It's funny because you forget about, so the eight year journey, you forget about the last 6 years and you think right back to the start. So I'm thinking back to walking back from the train station, going to uni and thinking, right, we need to invest everything for 2 or 3 years. And your mind jumps back to all the original sort of times at the start, like stamping on the hose pipe to push out the frost so I could clean down the screens and sew in the labels. Like, you just think back to the start and you think, like, almost like, how is this even possible? But the other thing is, because you've done so much, because everything is so data-led nowadays in business, it all makes complete and utter sense. So the robust business case is all there. So it makes complete and utter sense. It's not like an illogical, almost like, you know, lottery win sort of thing. But on a personal level, the feeling of being able to look after my family is the most fulfilling thing I've ever felt. Like, my mum's worked at the QE in Birmingham in the NHS since she was about 16, 17 years old. Like, I've watched her graft, do nights, come home, then take me to school, watch my dad work so hard, my grandparents work so hard, and have the opportunity to support them is single-handedly the most fulfilling personal experience of my life, I would say.
Brilliant, Ben. Honestly, well, brilliant. Well done, mate. Honestly, incredible.
Thanks.
Even though you're a Villa fan.
Let me just ask you two other questions. Just one thing I'm interested in on the business, because you had a really close friend, Lewis Morgan, who was with you in the business. I think he left 2016, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was that a wrench for him to go?
I think so. So it was going back to what I said at the start. So that was at the point where you make the decision as to how the business is going to proceed. Is it going to become this large? At the time, we were scared of it becoming corporate. And that was the thing, right? No entrepreneur wants their business to become too corporate. And I think what Lewis loved the excitement of being at the entrepreneurial phase and then looking down the route of where we were going, albeit for me, so exciting. You know, I want it to be as big and exciting as possible. For him, it just wasn't quite as enjoyable because there was more structure involved. So I think it was tough for him, but I think it was definitely the right decision for him. And, you know, he's doing very well for himself, and I think he's living a very fulfilling life now, and he's getting more involved with businesses at the early stages, which I think is much more exciting for him.
So let me ask you the last set piece question. What was the best piece of advice anyone has ever given you, and who said it?
That is very, very tough. Let me have a look. Let me see what I've written down. I keep my quotes on here.
Oh, that's nice. What, you in your wallet? You have a
every great quote I hear, I write it down. I put it on a wallpaper on my phone. Essentially, the one thing I think that sticks out from more of my professional life is, and it wasn't told by me, but it's something I saw someone say, and it was a guy called Jordan Peterson, who's a Canadian psychologist, and it always rings in my head. And it's responsibility gives meaning, and that's something that. When things are growing so quickly and, you know, expanding so rapidly in front of my eyes, and as my personal responsibility becomes greater and greater, both on a personal, public and professional point of view, I feel like I've got more meaning in my life the more responsibility I take on. And that's been really important to me.
And I think I'm right in saying, Ben, you have given back. I mean, you're not just about profit maximization. You do mm-hmm. try and make sure that you support communities, you have social and corporate responsibility. Just give us a brief flavor into what you're doing as a company.
Yeah, so I mean, even in the last few months with COVID happening, and like I said, having personal close ties with the NHS, we ran an NHS sweaty selfie campaign. So that was sort of twofold. It was get people out the house, get people staying active whilst gyms are closed during the COVID pandemic. And for every selfie that people uploaded, sort of sweaty selfie on Instagram or on social, we gave £5 to the NHS. So we ended up giving, I think, about 200 grand to the NHS.
Wow.
Something else that I'm really proud of that we did, which is a little bit more closer to home for our industry, was as gyms were announced that they were going to be closed, there was a lot of personal trainers who were concerned about what they do for their livelihood. So we have tens of millions in the Gymshark community. We put on a 24/7 live stream and paid personal trainers an hourly rate to jump on and basically personal train the community on a live stream. And again, just little things like that, I think they make a whole lot of difference, and they're really important to me.
Ben, thank you so much. Look, I can just say it's been a
incredible
huge pleasure
talking
to you.
Unbelievable, Ben.
I want to wish you all the best with what you do with the business, but I think you have a bigger role. I think our society at times has become a bit more cynical, a bit more divided, a bit more polarised. I think you're going to have a big role in helping to bring our country together.
Can I just say, Matthew, as well, I must apologise. Ben, for beating you all the time at Villa Park with the Blues. Peter yeah, Encomo and letting the ball under his foot. I don't think he touched it, Ben, and I don't care if he did. And I'll take another headbutt off Dean Dublin if Birmingham continue to beat Villa.
Birmingham continue to beat Villa?
When they play in the cup competitions.
I was going to say, I'd be lucky to be in the championship next year.
Oh, don't be like that, Ben.
Controversy. Robbie, by the way, mate, great to see you again as ever. Ben, thank you. And thank you for listening. Please remember to rate and review us wherever you get your podcast. Do spread the word about the pod. We'll be back next week with another great guest. But for now, from all of us, goodbye.